Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Hello there, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. I'm your host, Eric Peabody. And tonight, we continue the shameless self-promotion of our short story collection with two tales guaranteed to send a shiver up your spine. First, we have Black Eyes by Tom Farr, in which our protagonist just can't seem to catch a break. If deaths in the family and distressing medical diagnoses aren't enough, now strange things are starting to happen around his farm. After that, we'll be reading The Porcelain Hand by James Colton, where we learn that some bad eggs have a way of always turning up again, even after death. You know, listeners, this whole collection is available at this very moment. There's literally nothing stopping you from heading over to www.chillingbook.com right now to get a copy in paperback or ebook format. 30 illustrated stories by indie horror favorites such as Brian Martinez, Ted Hageman, and more. How could you even think of saying no to that? And if you prefer to ingest your books in audio format, the whole collection has also been narrated by none other than yours truly, and will be released later this month. Be sure to follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on your social media platform of choice for updates. You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author Tom Farr, I give you Black Eyes. The cold, impassive stars didn't bother him so much as the gaps between them did. Laird Barron, The Croning. Royce felt the rough stone corner of the porch under his hand as he kicked his shoes off and sat down. The barn was open and the sheep were out, and he could hear cowbells in the fields, as well as the low, steady chug of a tractor on some distant road. He sat on the porch steps drinking his third cup of morning coffee. Over the rim of the mug, he watched a powder of purples and reds talcuming the sky in the east. A flock of teal broke from the rushes surrounding the pond and went whistling into the unpredictable light, dropping away out of sight beyond the trees at the edge of the fields. He rose from the steps when he heard a van pull up in the front yard and saw the postman walking towards the farmhouse. He set the cup on the edge of the porch, stepped into his shoes without quite putting them on properly, and went on up the walk. "Morning," Royce said. The postman handed him a couple of letters and a flat manila envelope with an orange label on it. "Morning. Just need you to sign for this one." Royce signed for the package with some reluctance. It was as if he knew. "Thanks," he said, turning away towards the house. The postman raised a hand and went back up the walk. The van remained still for a few seconds, and then the postman beeped the horn and drove away. He sat back down on the porch steps, set the letters aside, and peeled back the flap on the envelope. The first thing he saw was a letterhead bearing the address Oak Park Hospital. He ignored the letter and withdrew a sheet of stiff white medical film that made a noise like jury-rigged thunder when he flapped it straight enough to read. An X-ray of soft tissue. A brain. His. He looked at it for a long time. Touched the dark shadow floating in the western hemisphere with the pad of his index finger, half hoping it might be a stain he could wipe away. He slid the X-ray back into the envelope, but after a few seconds took it out and looked at it again. After a while, he read the letter. A type 4, someone in the hospital had written. Inoperable. The dusk was hot and still, motes of hay dust shifting in the malevolent red light. Silence, save for the echoey sound of the sheep in the barn behind him and the somnolent drone of insects. He tried not to think of the X-ray, but when he did, he got a sensation in the pit of his stomach, not unlike the momentary surprise of picking up a heavy box you thought was empty. He was halfway to the house when he felt eyes upon him. He stopped and let his gaze go round the yard, along the trodden selvages of the nearest field. Shadows flooding the land like rising waters. The old orchard reverting to wildness. The bales stacked in the hay shed. He did a double take. There was someone standing in the orchard, cold and alien as the deep polynias of glacial water in the Arctic. Huge black eyes with nothing at all of life in them watched him from among the unpruned apple trees, gleaming like oil in the failing light. There was a burst of noise. A flock of blackbirds went crying into the air and wheeled above the farmhouse before clattering away out of sight. He looked back at the orchard, and while he was looking, an enormous white owl came gliding silently out of the gnarled and twisted branches, stretching its furred and strangely feline legs. It was there, then it was gone, tilted on a rising wind, just a pale shape dwindling against the benighted heavens. He finished doing his teeth and came out of the bathroom, sitting on the bed with his elbows on his knees. Dread lay in him like a cold stone. He pulled off his slippers and socks and lay back with his hands clasped behind his head. The roof formed an A above him, the simple planes and angles that stood plumb as any man with an affinity for the rightness of such things could plumb them. He could hear a car engine toiling somewhere in the night, the pitch of it changing as it went downhill, or perhaps up. Birds on the roof, scuttling. The metronomic clicking of the clock on the bedside table. After a while of this, he realized he would never get to sleep in bed, so he took the clock downstairs, put it on the table, and stretched out on the sofa. The television stared at him from the corner of the room, a dark, cataracted eye. He pulled a blanket about himself and lay staring at the ceiling above him. The clock ticked. A type 4. Inoperable. For a moment, he allowed himself to believe that he could go back upstairs and crawl in next to her warm body, but he was in this alone now, and she was gone. And even after 7.5 months, he struggled to accept the fact that she was dead. But the blanket, the ticking clock, the house around him, some combination of these things balled into a small modicum of bitter comfort. There was a brilliant wash of light on the window curtains, and the whole room rattled, groaned, subsided. He sat up very quickly, crossing the carpet to the window, holding the curtains aside with an upraised arm and peering out at that black, unmoving night. There could not have been any light. Beyond the glass lay only the dark stain of the cornfields and darker woods beyond that. In the morning, half a dozen cows in the bottom field were dead. There was a long, rubbery interval between the moment he saw them and when he began to vomit, spilling himself all over his Wellington boots. The cattle lay stripped and demolished like old cars in a scrapyard, warm steam coming off their bodies, rising from the cooked sockets of their eyes. Their tongues had been drawn out and severed at the root. They had been cleanly docked of their ears and udders, and the skin and superficial muscles removed from the hindquarters down. Every wound puckered and drawn, as if cauterized. Somewhere, a sheepdog began to bark. Over the field, the sound set off other dogs here too sleeping, and soon the air echoed with their frenzied din as if in a tableau of some old heraldic chase. No tracks, no blood, no nothing. The policeman swallowed down his sickness once more and bent forward to study one of the ruined cows. The raw vertebrae of its meatless spine, back legs hanging by hide. He took hold of a flap of skin and lifted it slightly. If anyone can show me how this happened, I will be happy to believe them. It's like it fell, Royce said. The policeman looked at him. It's like it got dropped from someplace high. The way the pelvis is all shattered to bits. But not a drop of blood. The radio on the policeman's vest staticked, and he straightened up and spoke into it, nodding. He looked at Royce and shook his head. We've had no other reports, he said. Well, Royce said. And you say you've been through the others? I have. There was a sort of appalled silence. And all the guts and organs scooped out like that, the policeman said eventually. Why in hell would somebody do that? In the days to come, Royce's life went on as usual. He grazed the cattle, fed the sheep, the dreadful weight of the X-ray bearing down on him whenever he stopped to take his rest. Things appeared otherwise unchanged. He drove into the town and looked on the internet about brain tumors, how they could cause visual hallucinations if they compressed the optic path. He was still uncomfortable. That light, he thought. But he had to get through on his own. What else could he do? He would not be taken away and put in a hospital bed while some doctor foretold his death in unemotional scientific language. He would stay here and bury himself in his work, in the small, modest life he... no, they had lived. Sitting out on the porch in the cool of the evening, watching barn swallows and starlings cross the watered sky, he thought about her, smiling in the fields. Then he thought about other things that had been better ignored. How the cancer had started in her ovaries, then it had metastasized. Then it was everywhere. Lung taps at the hospital every couple of days. Nurses in the hall whispering about radiation sickness. At first, she'd still been able to get out to the feeding yard, though it took quite a while. By the end, she couldn't even make it up and down the stairs. The doctor in his green surgeon's scrubs, flecked with bright dots of blood, like a butcher briefly divagated from his blood-stained balance, pushing his glasses back with his thumb. "I'm sorry." Dark now. He got a torch from under the kitchen sink and went through the feeding yard down to the bottom field to check on the cattle before bed. He leaned on the post and rail fence and looked at their dark bulks, could hear the suck and clap of their grazing. The air was full of the fecund smell of grass and milk. In the oval of the torch beam, a dozen eyes turned his way. He held it above his head to try to see anything beyond, but there were only other eyes ascending vertically from the ground, blinking on and off as bodies shifted and heads were turned away from the light. He was beginning to feel vaguely uneasy, an inky tendril of dread snaking down his throat and uncoiling in his gut. He began to sense a larger movement around him, a tangible, observant presence, hidden yet looming. He felt small, diminutive, like Gulliver among the Brobdingnagians, as if the sky had somehow lowered itself onto the resting earth and now threatened to crush him against its surface. The beam of the light played about the cows, the field, the opaque presences of night. He shined it heavenwards. The stars stood fixed in their sockets, and the blackness between them was vast and of a piece, and there was no sound at all save the faint tintinnabulation of cowbells and the rasp of his breathing. Nothing. Nothing except for the cattle, the old man clutching his torch, and the dark gulf of the cosmos yawning overhead, like a shadow on a sheet of film, occulting his brain like an eclipse. When he came down to the field the next morning, it was brewing to rain. One of the heifers was stretched out prone in the grass, and the others had unsettled and racketed further down the slope to get well away from her. He swung over the gate and knelt in the grass beside her. There was blood and fluid, and she was straining wildly, with her head pushed out and a white foam seething about the slavering tombstones of her teeth, as if trying to expel some entity of pain lodged within the ungiving bell of her ribs. She bucked and kicked and screamed when he put his weight on her. The black globes of her eyes rolled crazily. He didn't understand. Then he saw what had torn her in its laboring to be free of the thick, soft cell of the womb. The two heads were fused at the crowns of their slick skulls, and there were tiny florets attached to one of the necks that could have been the inchoate beginnings of limbs. The cow panted and groaned, trying again to shift as the life ebbed out of her like water down a drain. He'd seen twins get tangled and bunched up together, but never anything like this. Greased in blood and lubricant, the monstrous calf began to scream, a shrill, concordant wail that ceased within moments and did not resume. Necessity descended upon him, and he knelt in the blood-slaked grass and got his fingers between the calf's heads and the heifer's stout pelvis until his hand found a fetlock. The cow screamed as he drew the fetlock forwards, warm blood spattering his face and the faint coppery tang of it on his tongue. The fetlock led to a foreleg, and he moved his hand over the slippery flesh, vaulted ribs, and the exanimate heart that hung within. When it was done, he got up and went over to the faucet. He washed his hands under it and took a long, desperate gulp of water. His hands shook, his entire body. He did not understand. He had not run the bowl with the cows since breeding season, and the heifer had shown no sign of being due to calve. There was a soft curtain of rain misting his face, and he could hear the small patter of water drops and the dull lowing of the cattle at the bottom of the field. She would have known what to do. She always knew. When he turned to look, he saw that the heifer was licking the calf, and he looked at it, sloshed in the grass, without life. Gray rain falling grayly on eternally open eyes. It was 2 days since he dropped the calf into the old well behind the orchard, and dead black of night when the first sheet of lightning bloomed above the western horizon, and, after a moment, a peal of thunder like cathedral bells. Royce was awake, was too exhausted to sleep. He got dressed and went outside and stood leaning against the porch support, just watching the lightning flash mutely in the seamless dark. The air felt dense and oppressive and strangely breezeless. For a millisecond, the past seemed to engulf him. He stood staring as if at some other storm he'd long ago committed to memory, or some other repository for the faces of loved ones and the look of the world alike. The fields vanished in the pause of a crack of thunder that rattled the window panes, and when the lightning flared again in the ink-black bowl of sky, it provoked in adumbration an enormous, smooth, metallic oblong that lay across the horizon where the cornfields tended away to an ironwork frieze of trees, wrought as if by some crazed forger against the blue-black night. His breath caught in his throat. What in hell? The clock struck 3 in the kitchen behind him. The light had turned strange and thin, an almost faraway quality to it, and it seemed to him now that the clouds in the sky were scudding by at unnatural velocity while the strange oblong remained eerily motionless, its fusiform surface roiling with refracted lightning. He fancied movement in the cornfields, thought of the shotgun leaning in the corner of the bedroom, a 12-bore in a domain of rabbits, badgers, foxes, saw again movement through the fields towards him. In a harsh white bloom of light, he glimpsed a gray man watching him hypnotically from the corn with the oily black eyes of a mantid, cold and compassionless and evil. Others approached. The world vanished, reappeared out of the blackness, and in the fierce, mute photoelectric glare of the lightning, the things moving through that serried proscenium of stalks bore only a rudimentary resemblance to the eternal form of man. The strange metallic oblong pulsed with light, cycling yellow to green, green to red, and back to yellow again. And suddenly, as if a light bulb had been switched on in some dark, cobwebbed corner of his mind, the implications of the whole thing struck him. Radiation sickness. Her cancer, how it had spread so rapidly. The two-headed calf. the shadow on the X-ray. A type 4. Inoperable. He backed up until he could feel the kitchen door and got one hand behind him to open it up and backed inside, long quadrates of light thrown across him by the window panes. Abruptly, the storm ceased and the night grew still, unmoving. Everything was laden with a terrible silence. His eyes darted about the kitchen. He could hear his heart hammering, strong and fierce as anything. Visual hallucinations. Compression of the optic path. A pale polyp rose in the darker square of the window and he jerked back, one hand finding the edge of the table as time seemed to slow to a viscous crawl. The face was gross and misshapen, like a reptile kept in elephant's skin, and dominated by huge black eyes, cold and impassionate as a cat's. A hand cast its shadow across the tiles. Three long fingers splayed against the glass. He caught a flicker of movement out of the corner of his eye, the half-lit shape of another gray man moving stealthily past the dining room window. Wood groaned. Somewhere, a casement was rattled. The window pane went all black and empty. He was almost at the top of the stairs when behind him the garage door clicked open. The sound was like a gunshot at a funeral. Slowly, he turned to confront the doorway. It yawned, a vague black rectangle through which a thin, pallid figure ducked to vanish into the shadows of the hall. He fled. In the bedroom, with a rickety ladder back wedged between the knob and the door and the shotgun across his knees, broken open, still holding the dull green shells in his hand, he tried to map what he could not see. A quick series of bumps in the kitchen. Footsteps directly beneath him. A hopeless swelling of anger began in him. She was dead, and she had died for nothing. He felt his head, an old scar there that he couldn't remember getting, raised like the seam of a zip. A shadow spreading beneath the skull, dimming lights in a theater forever empty. He could hear them bounding up the stairs like dogs, eager to get inside. He loaded the shotgun and breached it in one quick, purposeful motion that was almost bellicose, almost militant. Radiation sickness. A type 4. Inoperable. The policeman stepped into the doorway, looked at the hole blown in the bedroom door hanging impotent on a single hinge, and crossed to the window. There were police cars parked in the yard and men coming down the walk in white forensic suits. He went back out onto the landing. Three more shots in the dark varnished wainscoting, evenly spaced in a staggered line, something deliberate about them. He squatted and picked up a shell casing out of the carpet and looked at the numbers stamped in the brass base. 12 bore, he said to himself. That old man must have given someone a shit pot full of trouble. He dropped the shell back into the carpet and went on down the hallway to the second bedroom. He leaned against the doorway and surveyed the room. The bed had been swung out into the middle of the room, and he could still see the depression in the pile of the carpet where it had been moved. He walked in and stood. The bathroom door was open, and the shotgun lay on the tiled floor. He went over to the bathroom doorway and thought for a moment. Then, he turned and put a phantom shotgun to his shoulder and sighted along the barrel. He walked back across the room, stepped around the bed, and inspected something on the blue damask wallpaper. It was a deep pocking in the shape of a shotgun slug, with some sort of coarse, wrinkled leather packed into it. A shadow swept the room, something pale, imagined or briefly glimpsed out of the corner of his eyes. He crossed the carpet to the window. It was raining, and he stood looking at the cornfields that lay beyond the wet panes. A white, daytime owl flew, spectral and soundless, across the strange gray land and into the strange gray sky.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk. Still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You've been listening to Black Eyes by Tom Farr. Tom Farr is an English writer of weird fiction and supernatural horror whose work has appeared in the pages of several anthologies and journals. His stories explore the darker side of art, theology, memory, and the natural world. If he isn't writing, he's probably reading, running, or getting tattooed. Next, here's The Porcelain Hand by James Colton. Alan gazed upon the body in the casket with relief. The sight of that obese figure, stuffed into its box, marked the end of a long, depressing chapter in Alan's life. He'd lived with his grandmother ever since his parents had died in an accident. As Alan grew up and grandmother grew senile, their roles gradually reversed. Alan became the responsible adult. Grandmother kept to her bedroom, tending to her ever-growing collection of dolls. That was her chief hobby, even before Alan came to live with her. But the change, as Alan called it, came after, triggered by the death of her daughter and worsened by old age. She filled her room with dolls, stacking them on the dresser, piling them in corners, gathering them into bed with her at night. Toward the end, Alan often heard her muttering to the dolls, speaking to each of them by name as if they were alive. Her conversations often revolved around Alan's father. Grandmother had never approved of him, never in all the days he'd been married to Alan's mother. One afternoon, Alan went upstairs to fetch grandmother for lunch. Mealtimes were the worst parts of his day. Usually, he could just ignore her, let her remain in her room to play with her dolls. But at breakfast, lunch, and dinner, he had to go get her, had to trespass on her domain. See her, speak to her, listen to her. This particular afternoon, her bedroom door was open just an inch, just enough for Alan to see inside before he knocked. What he saw made him pause with his hand raised. Grandmother was seated with her back to the door. She was a massive woman, comically round. The legs of the wooden chair on which she sat seemed to bend beneath her weight. What a sight it would be to see grandmother fall on her backside, rolling around the room like a beach ball in a windstorm. "Killed her, he did," she muttered in her creaky voice. "Reckless, disgusting creature he was. No consideration for daintier things. Just like all of them, they're all the same. Not like you, my sweets. Come here, Gwendolyn. Your hair is all knotted." She leaned forward to pick up a little blonde doll and began brushing its synthetic hair. Alan wished he could turn around and leave her, let her starve. He allowed his hand to fall at his side. Grandmother suddenly stopped brushing. The doll in her lap was turned so it faced the door, faced the gap where Alan stood holding his breath. Grandmother slowly turned her head, straining to peer over her swollen shoulder.
"Spying, are you?"
She rose with such force that her tiny chair flew back.
"Insolent brat!"
Her feet, so bloated they seemed almost toeless, pounded the carpet, propelling her forward in a rage. Alan instinctively stepped back, cutting off his view of the bedroom. He heard Grandmother charging toward him. Then there was a scuffle, a heavy whomp, and something massive crashed against the door, slamming it shut. It had taken a team of three men to force it back open, even more than that to carry her body down the stairs. Heart attack was the coroner's diagnosis. And now, here she lay, an overstuffed dummy surrounded by flowers. Harmless, and, most importantly, out of Alan's life. The house was his alone now. No more helping an old, demented woman up and down the stairs for meals. No more listening to her bitter diatribes. As Alan left the funeral, he felt a weight lifting from his shoulders. Freedom. Still, when he returned to his house that evening, Alan's stomach instinctively tightened. Years of memories, a conditioned panic response. He fought them down. The house was empty now. Just him. No other human beings to care for. No one's anger to appease. He headed upstairs to change out of his funeral suit. When he was halfway down the upstairs hall, between one step and the next, a chill embraced him. He became lightheaded. In a moment of unexplainable nerves, he drifted toward one side of the hall, away from something, something he knew and yet could not name. As quickly as it appeared, the feeling passed. Alan rubbed his arms and continued on to where his own room waited near the end of the corridor. Waited with an open door that admitted the last cheering haze of sunset into the hall. As he changed his clothes, Alan thought how quiet the house was. So peaceful. Ever since he was a child, Alan could remember hearing some proof of grandmother's presence. The clink of dishes in the kitchen sink, the shuffle of socks on carpet, the grumbling of a bitter soul. This silence was so much nicer. Alan didn't feel lonely. He felt liberated. A new world had opened up to him. He finished changing and began thinking of supper. It would be wonderful, only having to prepare a meal for one. Alan didn't even feel guilty over such thoughts. He'd spent so many years in thankless service to that woman, he deserved to be happy. But as he emerged from his room and headed for the stairs, that happiness vanished. Alan became hyper-aware. Each individual carpet fiber, every bump in the subtle texture of the drywall, all of it stood out to his eye in vibrant contrast. He even perceived the swirling wood grain of a door frame, sensed its patterns beneath the obscuring layer of white paint, could feel its texture without touching it, and yet the door itself remained a blur. A generic impression of the concept of door that his eye refused to rest on, his brain refused to clarify. Then Alan's foot came down. He took another step, and that eerie sense of awareness faded. He glanced over his shoulder without breaking pace, saw plainly that door in its frame in the wall, saw nothing to elicit such a nervous reaction. It was Grandmother's door, of course, shut, and behind it an empty room, nothing more. Alan thought about that room as he ate supper. He'd have to clean it out, get rid of all of Grandmother's things, especially those dolls. Then he could leave the door open, air it out, purge the last remnants of her awful memory from the house. But that could be tomorrow's task. For now, he just wanted to enjoy the fact that he'd only have to wash one set of dishes. In one hand, Alan gripped a black plastic garbage bag. His other hand rested on the doorknob to Grandmother's room. Placing it there had taken an enormous effort. Now, looking at it, it didn't seem real. It looked like someone else's hand resting on a doorknob in someone else's house. The sweat on his palm felt alien, something foreign to Alan's person. Something, perhaps, that bore witness to the tragedy of that room. He immediately wanted to run to the bathroom and wash, purify himself of the room's taint. Instead, he gripped the knob tighter, twisted it, and pushed the door open. The cold he felt was like a physical blow, like something had rushed out of the bedroom to strike him in the chest. After the initial shock had passed, the coldness remained as a bitter feeling between his stomach and spine, a primal urge to hide from those staring eyes. Those glittering eyes staring out of dead faces. Grandmother's dolls, arranged as she had left them, occupying the very same places they had on that day when Alan had peeked into the room. Except now, Grandmother's bulk no longer intervened. There was nothing to intercept those lidless gazes of paint and glass. Nothing to shield Alan from the full, icy weight of all those eyes. Get out, thought Alan. Get out of here. He took a step back, then stopped himself. No, this is my house. He unfurled the black garbage bag in his fist with a crack. The noise seemed to break something. The air became thinner, easier to move through. The eyes, they still watched him, but now Alan saw them for what they were, glass orbs set in porcelain shells. Their malevolence was imagined, a projection of Alan's memories. He was in control here. These crafted pieces of inanimate matter were not his masters. They were nothing. Worthless. Garbage. And so, into the garbage bag they went. First, a curly brunette. Then that abhorrent blonde. Alan remembered that one. The one whose hair Grandmother had been brushing when... It fell into the bag with a rustle and a clink. Alan swept across the room, clearing first the floor, then the bed, then the dresser. Within minutes, he collected all the dolls. His plastic sack was heavy with them, stuffed with dresses and ribbons and painted faces. Alan was about to tie the bag shut when he turned toward the door and saw one he'd missed. One lonely girl, seated on a chair in the corner. Watching him, waiting, wondering. Would he come for her next? Was she, too, destined for the black sack that had claimed her sister's? Alan met her gaze and challenged it with his own. You are just a toy, he thought. Don't look at me like that. He grabbed her by the hair and dropped her in the bag. Alan made one last scan of the bedroom to make sure there were no more dolls hiding in corners. When he was satisfied, he dragged the sack into the hall and, leaving grandmother's door open, continued dragging it down the stairs. Each step produced a clinking sound as tiny hands struck against painted rosy cheeks. Alan carried the bag out to the street and left it there on the curb.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Alan didn't return upstairs until bedtime that night. When he did, he lingered a moment at the start of the hall. The hall that was lined with doors, all flung open, all save one. That one. The one Alan had to pass on his way to his room. An oddly dark patch where the influence of the overhead lamp seemed weakened. Alan distinctly remembered leaving that door open. It must have swung shut during the afternoon. Perhaps a draft or unbalanced hinges. As Alan made his way toward that door, his chest tightened, worse than ever before. Why? It's empty now. His windpipe felt swollen, and his heart was but an iron lump in his chest. As grandmother's room drew closer, Alan's head turned of its own accord, refusing to let him gaze upon the door's blurring impression, the door his brain now refused to even imagine. There was no picture of it in Alan's mind, just an empty spot beyond his sight, a place where the house ceased to exist. A void. He stopped when he drew even with it, forced the welded vertebrae in his neck to twist back and acknowledge the closed door. It remained a blur, a vague shape in the wall, refusing to clarify until Alan gripped the knob in his sweaty hand. Then, he shoved the door open and forced himself to look inside. Empty. Just as he'd left it. No more grandmother. No more dolls. He darted in just long enough to grab a tiny wooden chair and prop it against the door to keep it open. Then he scampered, something he never thought he'd do as a grown man, all the way to his own bedroom. "They're gone," he told himself as he crawled into bed. "She's gone." Although Alan had thus far insisted he felt no guilt regarding grandmother's death, there must have been something, at least on a subconscious level, that worked its way out through his dreams. Black, cold dreams. Dreams of stiff limbs, icy soreness in his joints. He could see nothing, but he heard, as if from far away, a voice calling. A creaky voice. A voice he knew and hoped never to hear again. Alan sat up in the nether hours between night and morning. It had to be guilt. It was the most sensible explanation. He was about to roll over and fall back asleep when he heard a sound from out in the hallway. A thump, as of a heavy, linen-filled sack dropped on the floor, followed by an interminable dragging. Then there was a period of silence, a moment for Alan to realize he was holding his breath, and it started again. Thump. Drag. The sound moved along the hall. Thump. Drag. It drew near Alan's bedroom door. Thump. His heart beat out an echo to that final, gentle impact. The impact right outside his room. He waited for it to move on, to continue down the hall, to leave him alone. Thump. But not against the carpet this time. This time, it was against the wood of the door, softly against the top of the door. Up somewhere where the shadows rose and gathered in heavy bundles. And then it slid down against the wood, slid down and down forever until it reached the very bottom. And there, it seemed to spread, as if expanding dozens of little fingers to grasp the bottom of the door, to reach under the crack and gain purchase. And then, the most awful noise. The click of a latch. The plaintive squeal of brass turning against brass. Thoughtlessly, Alan threw himself off the mattress, onto the floor, and under the bed. There he buried his face in the carpet. Thump. Drag. Toward his bed. Thump. The mattress above his head shook. A swishing sound, like someone brushing their hand through the tousled sheets. The bed frame groaned as something heavy pressed its weight against it.
Where?
Rasped a hollow, creaking voice. Alan willed himself to sink into the carpet, to disappear through the floor.
Where are my girls?
The swishing above Alan's head became a violent thrashing and pounding. And then, thump. The pressure on the bed disappeared. Drag. Drawing back out of the bedroom. Thump. Drag. Out into the hall. Alan risked a glance from under the bed. His door was open, and what little he could see of the hall beyond was empty. As quietly as he could, he crawled out and stood up. The air was frigid. Little eddies, like fingers, tickled up his spine. He could feel each hair on his arms, rigid as needles against his skin. He stood there in his bedroom, listening, waiting for some sign that it was over, that whatever had invaded his room was truly gone. After a minute, he worked up the courage to go to his door and look out. The hall looked longer in the darkness. It seemed to stretch on forever, vanishing into black dizziness. Then, Alan gasped. Something moved. Something in the darkness moved. It tumbled forward, pulled itself along, gathered itself up, only to spill forth once again. At first, Alan could form no other explanation for what he was seeing other than that it was a great heap of laundry wrapped in a bulging sack. Then, as it rose a final time, he realized it was a figure, what in another context might have been described as a comically fat human figure, something out of a cartoon. But as it stood there with its back to him, there was no mirth to be felt, no laughter to be heard. Indeed, whatever air laughter required was sucked away, as if the thing that shuffled before him, now beginning to turn, had drawn all the oxygen into itself, drained the last of it in order to keep itself inflated. Alan heard the scuff of what he imagined to be feet, great, swollen feet without toes, and that linen bulk swung around, seemed to unfold, inverting itself in a slow lurch that he felt in his stomach and in the tightening of his chest. The figure was hunched. Beneath the asymmetrical mound of its shoulders hung a head that seemed far too small, a little round head draped in a shawl of yellowing lace. Out from under the tattered and puckered edges, through stray wisps of gray hair, peered a face. The most perfect face. Hard, ivory skin laid out in flawless curves. A high, smooth forehead. Crisply defined lips in a frozen smile. And yet, Alan's horrified gaze was drawn, in irresistible spirals across all that cold perfection, toward the two black pits, the empty holes, the infinite darknesses that were its eyes.
"Where are my girls?"
gasped the void.
"Where?"
Alan staggered back. His mouth was too dry, his throat too constricted, and his mind too disordered to form a response. The apparition tumbled toward him, collapsing in a rolling heap and billowing back up, lunging forward so that its terribly perfect face loomed closer. That face, just like the dolls grandmother used to love so much.
"Where?"
Alan backed into the wall and pressed himself against it, sliding along it toward his bedroom door.
They're gone," he managed to croak.
"Where?"
I threw them out."
The apparition before him went absolutely still, and so too did the air in the hallway. The temperature seemed to drop. Alan began shivering. If he could make it back into his bedroom, he could close the door and hold it shut, keep that thing out until morning, and then... The apparition billowed forward, unfolding and inverting like a wind-driven storm cloud. And always that face, craning out from beneath the stooped shoulders, reaching for Alan as if to swallow him in those empty eyes. Eyes that seemed to suck everything into themselves with a rattling gasp. Alan spun and smacked his forehead against the doorframe to his room. Points of light danced across his vision. For a moment, he could see nothing. He could only feel as something soft and delicate and bitterly cold began to wrap itself around his left wrist. Alan pulled away with a cry and, in another panicked spin, hurled himself into his room and slammed the door shut. He leaned hard against the wood, panting, trying with his left hand to grasp the knob and keep it from turning, but his fingers wouldn't work. They were too cold, too numb. They knocked against the metal doorknob with a clink. Alan looked down at the hand. His fingers. They rested in motionless arcs, uncannily still. Moonlight from the bedroom window highlighted perfectly smooth curves, textureless. Alan raised his other hand and gingerly touched it to those fingers. Cold and hard as porcelain, like a doll's. The door shuddered. Alan braced himself against it, using his good hand to hold the knob. He brought his other hand, his doll-like hand, the one the thing outside had touched, before his eyes. "What did she do to me?"
thump, thump, thump against the door. The knob twisted beneath Alan's sweaty palm. What could he do? His eyes flew to the bedroom window. Maybe he could climb out onto the porch roof. From there, make it to the front lawn. And maybe... His grip on the doorknob failed. Rather than try to regain control, Alan threw himself across the room, rolled across the bed, diving for the window. Behind him, he heard the door fly open, crash against the wall, and the dreadful sound of that thing's approach. Thump. Drag. With one hand, Alan fought with the window latch. It clicked open. Then he threw the window up, felt the cool night air wash over his face, felt it wash over every part of him, every part except for that emptiness at the end of his left arm. He also felt the sucking, gasping pull of the apparition closing in on him. He felt the hollowness of those black eyes boring into the back of his skull. Alan leaned out the window and kicked himself over the sill, out onto the roof. Something wrapped around his ankle, and Alan kicked it away with a scream. "Not my foot, too!" But it was just the curtain. Once he was free, Alan rolled several heart-stopping feet until he found traction on the shingles. Then, as quickly as he dared, he slithered down the slope of the roof until he reached the gutter. Alan didn't think the porch roof was that high, but now that he perched on the edge, the ground seemed dreadfully far away. His limbs seized up, refused to move him another inch. Then he heard the rustling sound of something moving through the curtains behind him, linen spilling out over the sill. Alan screamed and flung himself out into space. Air rushed around him. His stomach rose and fell. It seemed he hung there in the void of night for an eternity. And suddenly the ground was slamming into him, forcing his legs up into his gut. He pitched forward and rolled, only faintly aware of a sharp chink to his left. He sprang back to his feet and sprinted toward the street, toward the curb where a dark, amorphous lump sat waiting for the garbage truck. He lifted the bag, feeling the weight of all those dolls with a sense of relief, hearing the clink of their tiny hands knocking together. Then Alan looked down at his own porcelain hand, and his heart stopped. What remained of the appendage was laced with a spiderweb of cracks. The pinky finger and a large chunk of the palm were missing. Alan remembered his fall, that small, incidental noise. He felt sick. His hand, his ruined hand, permanently broken. An inhuman howl from the house reminded Alan that he wasn't finished yet. Hefting the garbage bag in one hand, he returned to the front door, grateful to discover that he'd forgotten to lock it before going to bed. Once inside, he set his burden down on the entry floor and waited. Thump. Drag. Upstairs, it moved down the hall. Thump. Drag. Alan stood on the landing and looked up the staircase. Thump. Drag. It slid into view at the top of the stairs, billowing up until the mound of its shoulders brushed the ceiling. Then it folded in on itself, collapsing to the floor. It slithered down the steps, pulling itself down with tiny hands, just like the dolls, just like Alan's. Alan stumbled out of the way as it reached the landing, and he pointed to the garbage bag in the entryway. "My girls?" the apparition hissed. Alan nodded, then reached down, used his teeth to tear open the knot that held the bag shut, and upended it. The dolls spilled out, spread out across the floor. The apparition lurched forward and leaned over the pile of dolls. A hideous, gurgling, cooing sound filled the air. Those tiny hands reached down toward the dolls. Alan didn't stay to watch anymore. He fled up the stairs to his bedroom, shut the door, and locked it this time. For good measure, he swept everything off his dresser, lamp, clock, keys, and shoved the piece of furniture up against the door to hold it shut. Then, he sat on his bed and waited for morning. The house was quiet when the sun came creeping in through the bedroom window. It had been quiet for hours. Alan pushed the dresser out of the way, unlocked his door, and gingerly pulled it open. The upstairs hall was pure. Sunlight streamed in from the other rooms. There was no sign of last night's disturbance. A bad dream, Alan thought, but the numbness from his left hand cruelly contradicted him. He crept out and made his way toward grandmother's old room. The door was shut. Did he dare open it? What did he think he would find? After standing there for several minutes, he finally worked up the courage to raise his good hand to the knob. Hinges squealed. The hallway brightened. Dozens of glass eyes stared at him from inside, unblinking, soulless. The dolls were neatly arranged, perched on the bed, on little chairs, atop the dresser. But nothing else was out of the ordinary. No sign of any other presence. Alan quietly retreated and shut the door. Maybe it was over. Maybe now, with her girls where they belonged, she would rest in peace. Alan considered going to the hospital about his hand, but what would he tell the doctors? And what could they possibly do for him? That afternoon, Alan went outside to look for the missing pieces. He found them, but they were too shattered to repair. His cracked and ruined hand would remain so. The gaping black hole where the pinky used to be would forever gasp at him. He was too afraid to look at it closely. Too afraid of what he'd see if he looked inside. The day passed so quietly that, when the sun began to set, Alan finally allowed himself to sigh in relief. It was over. She was appeased. He was so exhausted from his harrowing all-nighter that he decided to go to bed early. As he trudged down the hallway toward his bedroom, he paused. Had that been the sound of his own shuffling footsteps? The rustle of his pant legs sweeping against each other? A chill blossomed inside of him, and his gaze turned slowly toward the closed door next to him. Thump. Drag. And a low, creaky babbling, like ancient whispers. Alan left the closed door behind and retreated to his own room, shut and locked the door, hid under the bedsheets. She had what she wanted, Alan insisted. As long as she had her girls, he'd be safe. Alan rested his head on his pillow, the cold touch of his porcelain hand against his cheek, and tried to sleep. Thump. Drag. Thump. Drag. You've just heard The Porcelain Hand by James Colton. James Colton loves supernatural horror in the tradition of M.R. James and Shirley Jackson. He also writes epic fantasy, draws pictures of ghosts, and practices the dualist forms of swordplay. You can read more of his work at www.jamescolton.com. And with that, my friends, we conclude our evening at Horror Hill. I'd like to extend my thanks to both Tom Farr and James Colton for tonight's stories, and I'll remind you that you can head over to www.chillingbook.com to grab a copy of this collection for yourself. As always, I'll be back next week with more stories to make your blood run cold. I hope to see you all back then, and until that time, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com and we can talk details. That's ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks. Like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.